Hello, and welcome to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported LA Review of Books. I'm your host, Kate Wolf, editor-at-large for LARB, and I'm joined by my co-host today, another editor-at-large, Medea Ocher.
Hi, Kate.
Hi, Medea. And this week, we have Elizabeth Colbert on the show, and she is talking about her new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future.
What was your reaction to the book, Kate? I mean, I knew what was coming. I knew it was coming when I saw her name on the cover and I saw the title, but what was your reaction to the book?
I mean, I have to say, like, I am someone, as much as I am disturbed and completely, you know, believe in climate change and think about it often, I'm also someone who totally avoids reading much about it because I always fear that it's going to be so depressing. And I thought that this book was, as I was reading it, I was like, oh, actually, this is very interesting. And there's so much to think about. And I wasn't focusing so much on the meaning behind what the stories are until I got to like the very end. And then I did just like sob a little.
Yeah. Likewise, I also don't read so much about it. I mean, I think also part of it had been that over the past 4 years, the political, I mean, whatever, over the past of our lifetimes, the political situation hasn't been good, but in terms of climate change. But over the past 4 years, it has felt truly hopeless. And so I think that was a particular deterrent. But I agree. I think, so this book, Elizabeth Colbert is probably best known for Sixth Extinction. And this book is a little bit of a different take, I think, in that it's about human intervention in nature, and ultimately it has to do with climate change, definitely. But as she says in the interview, it's sort of a case, it's a series of case studies of the different ways in which we intervene. And she does sort of start small, which I think is also helpful in terms of thinking, you know, approaching the end and then starting to think about the very, very large repercussions of our constant interventions in nature, climate, speciation, evolution. I mean, genetic modification, you name it, right? There's like almost nothing that's untouched
there
by
is
human intervention.
That's why it's the Anthropocene,
But it's a very interesting conversation. And at the very least, if something isn't hopeful, at least it's informative.
Totally, yeah. I've definitely reverted to just like being a total misanthrope and praying for the hastening of the end, because I think that we deserve it, but that's just the only way I can cope. I just think I can't wait till the earth is free of us.
I agree. Also, my partner is often reading like sci-fi, and there's, you know, all these books about people sort of outlasting the universe and traveling somewhere else. And I'm like, just, you know what? Why? What are we doing? What are we going to bring to Mars? Exactly. Just leave it alone. Anyway, but in the meantime, we're here, and I guess we should have a podcast and a radio show. So,
exactly. So let's get to our interview.
Let's do it. We have Elizabeth Colbert on with us today. Elizabeth is the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, as well as the book The Sixth Extinction, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize. For her work at The New Yorker, where she's a staff writer, she has received 2 National Magazine Awards, which is not enough, and the Blake Dodd Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Her new book is called Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future, a book, as she says, about people trying to solve problems created by people trying to solve problems. In short, it's a book about harnessing nature and the many ways in which we have done that throughout the world and are looking into doing it in order to combat climate change. And the book explores the many, many downsides of the ways that we've attempted to do it. And Elizabeth is kind enough to talk about it with us today. So thank you so much, Elizabeth, and congrats again.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth, I think when I at least think of climate change, I think of it as the inadvertent reaction to the way that humans live on the earth. But this book focuses on a very, you know, applied kind of control of nature by human beings that also results in the world changing. I wonder, is that different than climate change in your view? Is that, you know, a substratum of it? Maybe you could just talk about where that fits in the bigger picture.
Yeah, sure. So a bunch of case studies, as it were, of ways that humans have intervened, I guess is maybe the word, or in natural systems. And we start with sort of localized cases and we move up to the broad and the global. And so climate change is the broad and the global. Obviously, the book starts off in Chicago, where in the last century, Chicago decided to, the Chicago River, which bisects the city of Chicago, used to run into Lake Michigan. It was the conduit for the city's waste for a long time. It's human waste. All of the waste from the stockyards were flowing into Lake Michigan. Lake Michigan was and remains the city's sole source of drinking water. So this was a very big problem. And humans decided to intervene in that natural system by reversing the flow of the Chicago River. And that was a tremendous engineering feat, a tremendous engineering marvel of its day, one of the biggest engineering projects of the time. It was successful. They reversed the flow of the Chicago River. And now Chicago's waste flows away from Lake Michigan down towards the Mississippi, really ultimately into the Gulf of Mexico. And so that's an example of a human intervention that had unintended consequences. That was a conscious intervention to reverse the flow of the Chicago River. It had unintended consequences, which I, you know, talk about in the book and which we can talk about. Then there are also many ways in which we've intervened, as you say, inadvertently. So climate change is a side effect, an unfortunate, to put it mildly, side effect of having burned a lot of fossil fuels and cut down a lot of forests. We didn't intend for that, but it's also a global scale intervention in a natural system.
So in terms of some of the case studies, they really range widely. You look at the Chicago River, you look at the pupfish in Death Valley, which I'd never heard of before, very interesting. You look at the toads in Australia. Can you talk a little bit about how you chose these different cases and what your feeling was in terms of what they illustrated about the ways in which we intervene in nature?
Well, each one of them represents a way in which we have intervened, as I say, either in some cases very consciously, in some cases unconsciously, but very consequentially. And in each case, people are looking to assert a newest form of intervention, the results of which we're not too crazy about. So in the case of the Chicago River, to go back to that for a second, what happened when, after the Chicago River was reversed, it was reversed via the building of this canal, the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, which connected the Chicago River to, as I say, ultimately to the Mississippi through a series of tributaries of the Mississippi. And that had the result of connecting these two major drainage basins in North America, the Great Lakes drainage basin and the Mississippi drainage basin, which used to be separate, have been separate for thousands of years. If you were a marine creature, an aquatic creature, you couldn't cross from one to the other. And now you can. And that has created all sorts of problems because now species can pass from one to the other. Both of those systems are highly invaded systems, lots of invasive species in both systems wreaking havoc on the Great Lakes, in the Mississippi. And in particular, we now have Asian carp in the Mississippi system. Asian carp are often thought of as one species. They're actually four species, but Asian carp have been incredibly successful invaders in many waterways. They make up something like 3/4 of the biomass now in many places, some places even more. They are really crowding out native fish. And the Great Lakes, folks who fish in the Great Lakes, the fisheries of the Great Lakes, really do not want them to get into the Great Lakes. So this has led to a whole new series of interventions where literally now parts of the river are electrified to try to keep species on their own side of what used to be this natural divide. So, you know, we intervened by creating this connection between those two basins, reversing the river, and now we're trying to intervene again to sort of impose a new form of separation without actually separating the rivers. So I think I say in the book, first you reverse a river, then you electrify it. And in each case that I look at in the book, something like that is going on where we intervened majorly, decided we didn't care for the results, and now are looking to intervene again.
And also, I don't know if I'm wrong, but the Asian carp were also introduced, right, as well. They weren't native.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And that's a really interesting story in and of itself. The carp were introduced with good intentions, I should say. It was a time in the 60s when, you know, Silent Spring had just come out. There was a lot of understanding that a lot of the toxic chemicals we were using to try to control, you know, what we refer to as pest species, were really dangerous to other creatures, non-target creatures, and also to ourselves. So there was a lot of effort to find what are called biocontrol agents. So sort of use one species against another species that you don't like. And that's really the ending of Silent Spring. If you read Silent Spring, there's a long discussion in that about how we could use biocontrol instead of this chemical control. And so these species of Asian carp were brought in to either deal with aquatic weeds. One species is an herbivore and it would eat aquatic weeds. Another species was brought in the hopes that they would help solve some of the, eat the algae out that would help solve some of the nitrogen loading problems that are caused by human sewage. These were brought in to do biocontrol. They got loose and they have wrecked havoc ever since.
Reading the book, what kept on just like coming back in my mind was the expression "return of the repressed." And it seemed to me, yeah, that any intervention would result in something much greater than anticipated, just even in the smallest ways. I guess I'm wondering, this isn't really in the book, but through your research, have you found like any, you know, very successful man-made kind of nature interventions that were able to continue and abate problems and didn't have a negative effect?
Well, I mean, on some level, many, many human, you know, the whole human project. I mean, you could argue everything we're doing is, you know, an intervention in a natural system, right? I mean, farming is an intervention in a natural system. Now, is there any major intervention, damming rivers, levying rivers? Is there any one of these that hasn't had, for some creature or another, some kind of repercussions that, you know, not necessarily ourselves? That's a really good question. I don't want to claim to have the answer for it, but I think that if you look down at a really nitty-gritty level, you would find that, you know, something's been displaced. Whenever you simply take land, plant a crop where there used to be a grassland or there used to be a forest or whatever there used to be, something was displaced when we did that. Now, many of those are lost in the mists of time. We've been farming much of the world for, you know, 10,000 years now. We don't know even what was there beforehand. But I think that we do kind of have to acknowledge that every space was occupied by something before it was occupied by people.
One of the examples in one of the chapters that I found particularly interesting was about New Orleans and the flooding of the Mississippi, which I think intuitively, I would not think that there were any inherent benefits to a river flooding necessarily. I mean, it seems relatively neutral in terms of events, unless, of course, there's people nearby or animals or any other kind of species that might be affected by it. But in the chapter, you make it clear that, in fact, what we have done in New Orleans is actually destroying New Orleans in a different way. Can you talk about that a little bit and the kind of reverse effect that our stopping of the flooding has had on destroying the city?
Yeah, so that's a really, really interesting and I would say sort of beautiful and elegant example of this phenomenon that I'm trying to bring to life here. So this story begins a long time ago when, you know, the Mississippi has been flowing for a long, long time and carrying a lot of sediment from the Great Plains down the Mississippi. And every year in pre-levee days, before the river was levied up, it would overflow its banks and dump a lot of the sediment as it was hitting the Gulf, slow down, dump a lot of sediment over the landscape. That would create what's known as a delta lobe, a bulge of land. And over time, the river, the gradient would get too steep. So much land had been created that the river would decide, this is not a good way to go. I'm going to take a faster route to the sea. And the river would sort of flip, totally change its course and take a faster route to the sea, lay down a new delta lobe. That is how all of the Mississippi Delta was created, how all of southern Louisiana was created over many thousand. Native Americans were living on that landscape, you know, even as it was being formed. And presumably, when the river overflowed its banks or when it changed course, they responded by being very adaptable, and they got up and moved. And then the French arrived in 1718. They found the city of New Orleans, and they have this sort of colonial mindset of, well, you know, we're not going to let this river push us around. The river's now going to have to stay put. And they begin this project. They get flooded out incessantly, you know, constantly. And they begin this project of levying up the river. And a lot of those early levees, that was really backbreaking labor. It was done by slave labor, absolutely. And they start levying up the Mississippi on both sides of the Mississippi to keep it in place. And now New Orleans is protected by billions of dollars worth of flood controls, flood walls, levees, revetments, I mean, pumping systems. It's just incredible water management system. But the end result of all that is that, and that has protected New Orleans. So New Orleans still exists, you know, it's still there 300 years later. But it's sinking very fast. It never gets a pulse of fresh sediment anymore. And that whole delta lobe that New Orleans is on is sinking very rapidly. And so now the proposal is, it's sort of untenable over time between the sinking and sea level rise. It's in a pretty precarious situation. And so now the proposal is, well, we're going to have to flood the area, but we can't, you know, just flood people out. So we're going to have to do sort of controlled flooding to counteract flood control and try to spread some of the sediment in the Mississippi that the Mississippi still carries, which now gets shot off the southern tip of Louisiana into the Gulf of Mexico. We're going to have to try to spread some of that over the land so that we can prevent the whole place from sinking away. And there are several really humongous new control projects underway that are going to attempt this controlled flooding to counteract the effects of flood control.
Such a mess. Yeah.
Well, it's a somewhat jury-rigged system, but it's possible. You know, this system worked for 300 years. Everyone loves New Orleans. I love New Orleans. It's possible that, you know, we can preserve it for another 300 years.
Yeah, it seems that often to really do the job, the cost, you know, in a lot of these cases, the cost would be impossible. And you would say the political will for a lot of these, you know, larger scale projects that would counteract projects that had already been done was not there. And yet, I wondered in doing this research if you heard different ideas about ways humans could adapt in the future, or if it was much more about maintaining status quo, just in the terms of the way we live in the kind of cities we live in, with the kind of accoutrement that we live in. How much have you heard scientists that you've interviewed talk about actually like adapting the way that humans live?
Well, there is a certain amount of discussion of that. There was, for example, a competition held several years ago for New Orleans. So let's take the example of New Orleans. Should New Orleans be a very different city with a different landscape where the Mississippi would basically, you'd sort of give up on this part of Louisiana that's south of New Orleans now, which also takes a tremendous amount of engineering to keep that land above sea level, or at least it's probably not even above sea level, most of it, but from flooding constantly, you'd sort of just give up on that. You'd have a shorter delta, and you'd have sort of try to make more space for the water. So there are a lot of, and now I should add that competition got finalists some very elegant and beautiful looking proposals, you know, of a sort of rebuilt delta or re-engineered delta to accommodate more water. Those plans did not go anywhere because of precisely what you're suggesting, I think, which is that, you know, people are pretty dug in. We're in this paradoxical situation once again where we've created a lot of change, but we're not really keen on change. So we are going to have to, just to keep things the same, we're going to need a lot of change. So that is the paradoxical situation that we're in, that we're actually trying to conserve what we have, but that requires increasingly radical interventions just to keep things the same and sort of go with the tide more. But that runs into, as I say, as you suggested, a lot of political opposition because someone's you know, house is going underwater, someone's farm is going underwater. There's no sort of, you know, free lunch here, as it were.
In the case study that you look at with the toads in Australia, it's a very specific way to look at a much bigger question, which is the issue of genetic modification. And you actually do your own little genetic modification experiment. You create your own strain of E. coli. Did you make it glow? I don't know if you ever...
I was not successful on that. That one didn't work. I don't know what happened, but I did try it, but it didn't work for me.
Well, I'm actually kind of glad it didn't work. That seems like relatively good news. And so you dive into the questions, the ethical questions around genetic modification and CRISPR. I think that's maybe how you would pronounce that out loud.
Yep.
Can you explain for people who might not really, even though probably most people have in some way encountered this, even if it's in the sensational story from China, but can you explain what CRISPR is and what... sort of what the implications are of its use, because they are sort of enormous.
Yeah, sure. So CRISPR is an acronym, which I won't even go into what it stands for, but it's basically a system that was discovered in bacteria. It's all borrowed from bacteria. And it was discovered that bacteria, that, you know, two scientists just won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of CRISPR. It was discovered that bacteria have the ability to sort of incorporate little bits of viral DNA into their own genome. And then they use that to go out. And when they're being, you know, attacked, preyed upon by a virus that they recognize, they can go out and cut the DNA of that virus in a very precise location. And what scientists figured out how to do just within the last, you know, decade or so is harness that power. So now, instead of, you know, the bacteria giving those instructions, humans can give this enzyme very precisely. And that is the basis of genetic engineering. Scientists have been using genetic engineering, as everyone knows, for quite a while now. But what CRISPR does is it makes it a lot easier, a lot faster, and this is key, cheaper. So that is why, you know, I could order a kit, you know, for $200 that allowed me to create an antibiotic resistant strain of E. coli. And that has opened up just vast vistas of manipulating the natural world now. Now you could, once again, in theory, do a tremendous number of things, and also sets this new system apart from other forms of genetic engineering, is all of these, the tools are themselves encoded in DNA. So you can encode the tools, you can genetically engineer a creature that can pass on the ability to edit its own offspring's DNA. And that opens up the possibility of what's become known as gene drive, which means not only do I put a creature out into the world that's genetically engineered, but it can reproduce and pass on these traits and push them out into the world so that they're not diluted when this organism finds a mate. They're actually pushed out to more and more of the population. And people have probably heard about the possibility of gene drive mosquitoes that would self-destruct. Basically, they'd pass on a very deleterious mutation that would eliminate populations of mosquitoes. And this is being very seriously contemplated for, you know, malaria control. And you can say that's great, better than using toxic chemicals, for example, pesticides, which, you know, are poured all over the world in malaria control now. Or you can say, you know, that's the most frightening thing I've ever heard of. You'll get rid of every mosquito on the planet if things go wrong. Lots of things, we might not like mosquitoes, but lots of the living creatures in the world depend on them. And so this goes on and on. You know, these mosquitoes are just the first of what could be many, many, many manipulations of many, many different creatures. Once again, in theory, any creature, including humans, that opens up a whole other can of worms, as it were.
You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, recorded remotely. We've been speaking with Elizabeth Kohlberg, author most recently of Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. We'll return to that conversation in just a moment, but first we have this week's book recommendation.
I have Carla Cornejo Villavicencio on the line with me right now. Her book is called The Undocumented Americans, and Carla's joining us to give us a book recommendation. Carla, what book are you going to recommend?
I'm going to recommend a book called Children of the Land by Marcelo Hernandez Castillo.
Okay, tell us about the book.
It is a book written by a poet, which I love the genre of memoirs, nonfiction written by poets. And it is just chock full of references, which I also love. It's very poppy. And I read some of it, but it was too, it's sort of memoiristic about his life as an undocumented person, as a young man dealing with his relationship with his abusive father, and they share the same name, and kind of just his relationship with his father. But it was so true to what it's like to be undocumented and to be obsessed with your father and to work through those issues that I had to stop reading it. And Marcelo and I DM'd each other, not knowing each other at all. And we were like, we cannot read each other's books because they're too realistic about what it's like. And so I think when people are like, if two astronauts make a drawing of space and say, I cannot look at that painting because it reminds me of space too much, and those were the darkest times in my life, I think you should trust those astronauts and buy their paintings of space if you're looking for a painting of space.
That sounds right. Did you ever finish the book?
I did not, because it is very triggering to me. But what I have read of it is extremely good writing. He's a really good writer. And I have heard him do readings of it, which is really good because he is a poet and he knows how to do readings. And he is a lot nicer than I am. So I really recommend that, book. Because again, it's if you're looking for a book about immigration, I think he's pretty up there about someone you should go to.
All right. Will you tell us the title of the book again and the name of the author?
Children of the Land by Marcelo Hernandez Castillo.
Great. Thank you so much, Carla.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with Carla Cornejo Villavicencio. Her book is called The Undocumented Americans.
You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour. We now return to our conversation with Elizabeth Kohlberg, author of Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. I feel like you play your cards pretty close to your chest in this book as a journalist who's really trying to tell a story and not introduce too much bias. Can I ask, in that question of the genetically modified mosquitoes, where do you personally come down on that? or geoengineering, or all these things that you talk about that I can hear like a slight wariness just in the way that you tell the story, but at the same time, right, like, do we have other choices? You know, these kind of questions, I wonder, especially after writing this book, where do you stand?
Well, that is a very good question. And I, you know, do sort of, you know, purposefully play my cards pretty close to the vest. But, you know, I have a kind of, you know, pretty traditional, you know, conservationist mentality. I'd like the world to stay the same. I'd like to preserve as much of it in all of its, you know, magnificence as possible. But in the course of researching the book, I would say my own attitude tilted somewhat, because, you know, it's a little bit like the, you know, things people say on Twitter, I guess, you know, wrong answers only. It's like bad alternatives only. I mean, there are no perfect alternatives anymore. And I think that, you know, we're not preserving the world as it is. We have so fundamentally altered it. So even if you, for example, fence off part of the world, you say, well, we're just going to preserve, you know, the Amazon. Big ask, you know, a lot of competing interests here. But because the climate is changing, you know, everything that lives in the Amazon is sort of going to be on the move, right? So whatever you try to fence off is still going to change. So we're in this regime of sort of perpetual change. And how we best deal with that, I don't think there are clear answers. And I think that some forms of genetic manipulation may be, in some cases, the best answer we have. That's not a happy thought, but I think we have to be honest about what our choices are.
And the same token, you know, knowing how drastically and irrevocably things have changed, I think I was moved and also almost puzzled by the story of the pupfish in Nevada, in Devil's Hole, that it's a fish that is only found there in this big underground cave. The effort that's been put into saving it is huge. And I guess, you know, and now it's a conservation reliant species, right? Which you talk about, which it needs intervention to exist. And just as a layman, it's like kind of like, why? So why with so many other species lost, why put in all this time to save this small pupfish? And, you know, it's amazing that people do it. And I wonder, what is the reasoning at this point?
You know, because most of your listeners probably aren't familiar with the pupfish. I'll just tell the story very briefly. The Devil's Hole pupfish lives in one cavern in the Mojave Desert. How it got there is kind of an extravagant mystery. No one really knows, but it evolved to live in this one pool of water that connects to this vast underground aquifer in the middle of Mojave, and it only exists in that pool. And it's a very distinctive fish. It's a beautiful blue color, and it lost its pelvic fins somewhere along the evolutionary, you know, line. So it's very distinctive looking. And in the 60s, someone decided to start pumping water from right near Devil's Hole from this aquifer, and the water level in the cavern started to sink, and the Devil's Hole pupfish was clearly heading towards extinction. And so people started all sorts of manipulations. They hung lights in the pool. They fed the fish. They created a fake sort of styrofoam shelf because they hang around on this limestone shelf. They did all sorts of things. And finally, it was decided that that was not sufficient and they were going to have to build a completely fake cavern, a replica of the real cavern, completely fake cavern, which is replicated down to the contours of the real cavern about a mile away. So there are now two populations of Devil's Hole pupfish, one in the real cavern, very small population, one in the fake one, also very small population. Okay. So the simple answer, the sort of most direct answer to your question, why do this, is the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act kicked in. The Devil's Hole pupfish was one of the first creatures to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. Once you're listed, you have to have a recovery plan. So that's sort of the legal explanation for why I do that. The more abstract answer is this is a really magnificent species. It has something to tell us about life, about survival. It survives under very difficult circumstances. I should add this, that the water in Devil's Hole is like 93 degrees Fahrenheit. There's very low oxygen. Most fish would be dead, but the Devil's Hole pupfish somehow survives and only survives. So in the fake Devil's Hole, the water is also 93 degrees. There's also very low oxygen. And so it has something to tell us about survival under very difficult circumstances. You know, do we want to lose a species? You know, you lose an answer to the question, how do you survive on planet Earth? And so you can say every species down to the most minute, you know, is a tragedy. And I subscribe to that. But, you know, the question, what I hear behind your question is in an, you know, age of limited resources, et cetera, how are we going to make these sort of triage decisions? And the answer, unfortunately, right now is we're making them very willy-nilly. And if a species is lucky enough to get listed, it will get a recovery plan. If it isn't, quite possibly it will just wink out, you know, before anyone has bothered.
It's a happier story than these other stories, but it also does seem like the survival of this species at this point is also a man-made intervention. Do you know, not in a negative way.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. The devil's hole pupfish, I don't think anyone would argue it would be extinct if it were not for people constantly. I mean, people are constantly on call, you know, to attend to them. They're still getting supplemental food. They, at the cavern, you know, at the fake devil's hole, you know, someone is monitoring every parameter, like 80 parameters are measured every single, you know, continuously. And if something goes wrong, people get a phone call and they have to go out and try to figure out what's wrong. So as you mentioned, this is, you know, a classic sort of conservation reliant species. It's a very, it's a somewhat extreme example, but there are, you know, thousands and thousands of species that fall into this. Now, you guys are in California. The California condor is a conservation reliant species. Absolutely. It was a species brought back from the absolute brink of extinction and now is out, you know, quote unquote, in the wild, but very carefully monitored, still out there, you know, eating lead shot, which is used to kill deer, having to get de-leaded, basically brought in for treatment, you know. So this list goes on and on. Many, many species, I'd say the vast majority of species that were brought back from the brink are still dependent on some form of human intervention to survive. One of the few really happy examples where that's not the case is the American eagle, which has now come back because we, thanks to Rachel Carson, stopped using DDT, and the eagle has now finally come back.
So I think I'd like to make time to talk about the final couple of chapters in your book that are dedicated to solar geoengineering. That's also what gives your book the name, Under a White Sky. And so speaking of triage, it seems like we should, that's probably the biggest form of what looks like triage. Can you explain to listeners what solar geoengineering is? Maybe not the whole thing, I know that would take a little while, but... Because it also, I think, raises interesting questions about some of the other things that we've talked about, which is choice and how much choice we really have in the matter and how many options we really have. I mean, human intervention is creative. It seems, you know, we're not running out of ideas necessarily. Maybe we should run out of ideas. Just get it over with. But anyway, so it's a good conduit, I think, for some of the other sort of bigger questions that you raise in the book. So would you mind, yeah, just explaining what solar geoengineering is?
Right. So in the process of reporting the book, I spent a bunch of time actually at Harvard, which hosts what's called the Harvard Solar Geoengineering Research Program. And the idea behind solar geoengineering is that, you know, we've already intervened. We've intervened in the climate very dramatically by pouring a lot of carbon dioxide into it. That's, you know, mostly from burning fossil fuels, also from cutting down forests. And, you know, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. I'm sure your listeners are all familiar with this by now. That's climate change. Carbon dioxide traps heat near the surface of the earth. That's why we're getting global warming. Okay, so one of the really, really profound challenges for dealing with global warming is that carbon dioxide, once you stick it up in the air, it hangs around for a long time and it will continue to warm the earth for a long time. So it's really hard to come up with a strategy to deal with climate change quickly, to reverse course here. And one of the few methods that scientists have come up with, intervened one way in the atmosphere by dumping a lot of carbon dioxide in. Now we would intervene in a new way. We would shoot some kind of compound into the stratosphere. We'd need a fleet of specially designed planes to do this. We might use sulfur dioxide. We might use calcium carbonate. This is kind of up for discussion right now. And what that would do would be it would create this reflective haze, which would bounce sunlight back towards space. So we would actually be receiving less direct sunlight on Earth, and that would have a cooling effect. And perhaps we could, you know, counter the effects of the carbon dioxide we've dumped into the atmosphere by dumping more stuff into the stratosphere. Okay, now, you know, when you say it that way, it's like, you know, definitely what could possibly go wrong? And people, there are many scientists who consider this, you know, I quote one of them, I think he says a broad highway to hell. But there are many other scientists who would say, look, what are our choices? Once again, only bad choices. If you can get, if you're going to get to a point, and it's very possible that we will, where, you know, agriculture is disrupted, fisheries are disrupted, the, you know, Greenland ice sheet is melting with potentially, you know, 20 feet of sea level rise behind it. And you could potentially, with this method, ameliorate that, could have a cooling effect. Can you write that off? And that is a question that, you know, we're not going to answer tomorrow or the next day, but may assert itself. And one of the interesting things about geoengineering, solar geoengineering, is it could be done pretty, you know, not by an individual. It probably can't be like a James Bond movie where one, you know, bad guy decides to do it by himself, but it could probably be done by a group of countries. The whole world wouldn't have to agree to it. A group of powerful countries could decide to do it. You know, you could also imagine World War III breaking out. There's all sorts of things you can imagine about it, but it raises a lot of pretty profound questions.
I'll say.
Yeah. And I should also say, I will also explain that if you shot these, you know, reflective compounds into the stratosphere, you'd have to keep doing that, right? They would fall out of the stratosphere after a couple of years. So you'd have to keep doing that. And one of the effects that they would have were in a place where now, you know, a pretty unpolluted place where you would expect to see a bright blue sky on a sunny day. If you were doing solar geoengineering, the sky would have sort of a whitish tinge. And that's where the title comes from, Under a White Sky.
You know, just to close, I wonder, you know, reporting out this book or and all the work you've done, I'm sure people always ask you, you know, how do you keep hope? how aren't you so depressed? I mean, I'm sure you just get that question all the time. But I also wonder if the goalposts of hope for you have changed, knowing everything you know about, you know, where we're possibly headed and all the ideas that people have to maintain not really a natural status quo, but more a human life status quo, the eventual outcome of humans not being able to live on the earth, if that ever seems like hopeful.
I think that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I wrote a book called The Sixth Extinction. And after that came out, you know, the question I would always get is, are humans going to go extinct? That seemed to be, you know, despite my best efforts, what people really cared about. And my answer to that is, if you were betting on a species that could live with humans on the planet, well, humans would be high up there, right? Humans are incredibly adaptable. We live, you know, in Antarctica. We live in many, many different climates, many different, you know, habitats, as it were. We're very smart, and we have these amazing technologies. So I don't think, you know, humans are in danger of going extinct anytime soon. And I don't think they're in danger of, you know, not being able to live on planet Earth. But there's a big, big gap between going extinct, which would require, you know, all 7.8 billion of us or whatever to die out, and everything proceeding, you know, happily ever after by the standards of, you know, 2021. And I think one of the lessons of COVID is, or should be, you know, things can go south in all sorts of ways that are and are not anticipated. That, you know, the unanticipated is increasingly going to happen. That doesn't mean, you know, that we're all suddenly going to, you know, give up and that the world is going to come to an end. There's all sorts of forms of muddling through, you know, some better and some worse. And that gets us a little bit back to the question of, you know, do I subscribe to any of these interventions? What do I think of them? And, you know, the fundamental answer is, I'm not sure. As I quote one of the scientists talking about geoengineering in the book, he says, you know, we don't get to decide. Scientists don't get to decide. The political system will decide. And that's also my, you know, sort of defense as a journalist. I don't get to decide. I can put this out there and point out to you the potential benefits and the potential perils of what we're doing. I'm trying to sort of point out a pattern of the human mind that, you know, we get to a point and the next thing we reach for is a new form of intervention. That's sort of the pattern that I'm identifying. But whether that's good or bad, whether there are better alternatives that we can find, that is kind of not my call. And so I want to put that out there and I want to get people thinking about it because I feel pretty confident these are going to be the big issues of the coming century. I have kids. I am very concerned about what the world will look like for them, but I don't get to decide.
That seems like a good place to end. At least for those who think that this is an optimistic book, maybe a good place to end.
Exactly. You can take it however you want. How's that?
Yeah, that's nice. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth, for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Elizabeth Colbert. Her new book is called Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future.
Thanks for listening to the LARB Radio Hour. Subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate us on Apple Podcasts. That will help us get the word out, and we'd love to hear from you. The producers of the LARB Radio Hour are Medea Ocher, Kate Wolf, and Eric Newman. The executive producer is Alan Minsky. Our sound engineer is William Broughton. Editorial production by Jake Levins. Our intro music was written and performed by Imogen Teasley-Vlotten. The publisher and editor-in-chief of the LA Review of Books is Tom Lutz.